Why was the government of Honduras overthrown in 2009? Were the social reforms brought about by President Manuel Zelaya a reflection of solidarity with the people or with the oligarchy? Did Canada play a role in the successful execution of the 2009 Honduran coup? How do Canada and Canadian businesses benefit from the crushing of social movements in Honduras? What kind of human rights violations have taken place in Honduras since the coup? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at the 8-year-old coup that removed the Honduran president from power and the Canadian interests that enabled and benefited from that scenario. Our guest for the hour is professor, researcher, and book author Tyler Shipley. On this week's program, Canada and the Military Coup in Honduras, a conversation with Tyler Shipley. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 15th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In Abrams v. United States, 1919, Justices Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes called disagreement with free speech never a reason to condemn it. Their views strongly influenced nearly all subsequent High Court First Amendment rulings. If Israel anti-boycott legislation is enacted, federal courts should strike it down, affirming its unconstitutionality. Scores of human rights groups oppose it, including the ACLU, Center for Constitutional Rights, Council for American-Islamic Relations, Peace Now, and Jewish Voices for Peace, among many others. In a joint statement to Congress, they expressed strong, quote, opposition to this unconstitutional, draconian bill and to affirm the First Amendment right of all people in the United States to support political boycotts as a means to achieve justice and equality for Palestinians, unquote. That comes from the article, U.S. Anti-BDS Legislation Punishes Solidarity with Palestine, by Stephen Lendman, posted September 13. The UNWTO Human Rights for Tourists to Travel does not always apply when it comes to visiting Palestine and having to deal with Israel's rules. From time to time, Israel puts more restrictions on tourism to Palestine, including disallowing Western visitors to re-enter Israel when staying in a hotel in Palestine. However, cooperation between Palestine and Israel is an important and successful activity, and organizations, including the International Institute for Peace Through Tourism and its founder, Louis D'Amour, had worked tirelessly for decades to make both Israel and Palestine understand the importance of tourism and peace. Louis D'Amour will be attending the UNWTO General Assembly in Chengdu next week. The Israel Foreign Ministry's spokesman said that Israel's position is that the state of Palestine does not exist, and therefore it cannot be accepted as a state in the UN or in any of its affiliated organizations. That comes from the article, Israel, There is No Palestine. It cannot be allowed to join the World Tourism Organization. UNWTO, by Jürgen T. Steinmetz, posted September 12th, originally appearing at eTurbo News. Palestinians living near the village of Douma in the occupied West Bank district of Nablus have been told that the sole water pipeline servicing the area will be removed by Israeli occupation forces as it was deemed quote-unquote illegal. Palestinian news agency Wafa reported that Ghassan Daglas, a Palestinian official who monitors Israeli settlement activity in the northern occupied West Bank, said that Israeli forces had informed the residents of their intention to remove and destroy the pipeline. Douglas said that the pipeline is the sole water source for the area. According to Wafa, 14 Palestinian families live in the area and depend on the pipeline. A spokesperson for COGAT, the agency responsible for implementing Israeli policies in the occupied Palestinian territory, told Man that the pipe was installed in the area as, quote, part of an attempt to build an illegal residential complex at an archaeological site where construction is prohibited, unquote. That comes from the article, Israel to Remove Palestinian Village's Sole Water Pipe, posted September 11th, originally appearing at Middle East Monitor. Israel is attempting to thwart a Palestinian bid to join the United Nations World Tourism Organization, or UNWTO, arguing that the State of Israel does not exist, according to the Jerusalem Post. The Palestinian Authorities, or PA, Ministry of Tourism, applied for membership into the organization last year, and the issue is on the meeting agenda of the UNWTO General Assembly in China, which begins on Monday and runs through Saturday. The UNWTO is based in Madrid and describes itself as, quote, responsible for the promotion of responsible, sustainable, and universally accessible tourism, unquote. Israel has endeavored to block the move by appealing to the outgoing WTO Secretary General Jordanian diplomat Taleb Rifai and China, where the conference is being held. Tel Aviv has also involved the U.S., which has reportedly asked PA President Mahmoud Abbas to refrain from engaging in international organizations until the U.S. releases its updated peace plan, warning that to act otherwise could damage their bilateral relations. That comes from the article, Israel Campaigns Against Palestine Joining UN Tourism Body, posted September 10th, originally appearing at Middle East Monitor. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. We're speaking with Tyler Shipley. He's professor of culture, society, and commerce at the Humber Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning. He is also an associate fellow with the Center for Research on Latin America and the Caribbean. And he's joining us right here in the CKUW studios in Winnipeg on the occasion of the release of his book, Ottawa and Empire, Canada and the Military Coup in Honduras. Tyler Shipley, welcome to our show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, is there anything you'd like to say at the outset, maybe to help us understand how you came to be connected with this issue specific to Honduras?
Sure. Yeah. You know, the funny thing about it is that I really I fell into this project very accidentally. I happened to be in Central America in 2009 when the coup happened. I wasn't in Honduras. I was in Guatemala, but it was front page news. It was all over the TV news in the region. It didn't make such a blip in North America, but in the South, it was a big deal. And so I happened to be there, and I was following the news as it was happening. And I very, very soon went to Honduras to sort of be part of this national resistance movement to the coup. And so when I first went to Honduras, it was not as a researcher in particular. It was as an activist, a citizen, just somebody that, you know, I wanted to help people who were struggling to preserve their democracy. And I guess when it went from sort of a solidarity effort into a research project was in the months following the coup, when I noticed consistently that Canada came down on the wrong side on this issue. You know, and one or two times you might forgive and say, well, you know, maybe they didn't know the circumstances, or maybe, you know, they were misinformed on this. But when you start to see a consistent pattern where Canada comes down on the wrong side, literally supporting a military dictatorship, that really begs big questions. For me, it really begged you know, the question, how is it possible that I have been told my entire life that Canada is a peacekeeper, that Canada is an honest broker that wants to do good in the world. And here I am in this very small country in Central America watching, watching a dramatic injustice play out that Canada is supporting.
I'm curious, was this the first time that you'd clued into the idea that Canada was less than benevolent on the world stage?
It wasn't. And I mean, in some ways, that's maybe what is remarkable about my experience in Honduras. I had no illusions. Of course, I'd been taught all of the things that are good about Canada. And I had long since realized that they were exaggerations, in some cases myths, in some cases, that there was a real dark side to Canadian foreign policy. But I had never thought about it systematically. I'd always imagined, I suppose, that it was, about policy choices here or policy choices there. It was only when I was in Honduras that I realized that, in fact, it was systematic. And that my sort of, I guess, my shock at Canada's decision there, and I shouldn't have been, and I knew that I shouldn't have been, but I still was, right? And I'll give you an example. In November of that year, the coup took place in June, and in November of that year, I was in Honduras during a series of what can only be called sham elections. They were an absolute outright sham. Most of the international community refused to even recognize them. In fact, really liberal institutions like the United Nations and the Carter Center did not send elections observers because they refused to even legitimize the process. This was an election held under martial law, under a military dictatorship, with hundreds of candidates having withdrawn their names, with the social movement having boycotted and refused to participate in the election. This was not an election. This was not a legitimate election. And I was there and I witnessed it. And I I'm taking notes and I'm meeting people and I'm in the streets and I'm at the voting stations. And that night, I'm in a small hotel in Tegucigalpa, and I get the statement, the Canadian statement, in its response to the coup, to the election. And the Canadian statement says, "Canada congratulates the Honduran people on holding relatively free and fair elections." And I was stunned, and I shouldn't have been. I shouldn't have been so naive, and yet, I even knowing what I knew about Canada, I couldn't believe that they would sink to the level they had sunk to, that they were claiming with no evidence, because I was there. There was no evidence that relatively free or fair elections had taken place. There was ample evidence of the opposite. Canada still issued that statement.
That was under the Harper government, and the foreign affairs minister was Peter Kent.
Yes. Yeah.
Who was a former journalist.
Right. You would expect better from Peter Kent, wouldn't you? Or I used to.
Maybe not.
Yeah. Certainly he presented himself as this, honest broker, an old journalist who, was going to sort out the truth. And for Peter Kent to issue that statement, I was flabbergasted. And it struck me at that moment that this is more than just one misguided policy framework. There is something systematic at work here. And that's when I started doing, a deeper reading of Canadian foreign policy, over time, and also a sort of a deeper analysis of where foreign policy is generated, where it comes from, who decides, how, was it specific to the Harper government, or is there some consistency across conservative and liberal governments? So interestingly, the project was born out of, I guess shock and a need to explain something.
Okay. I know that I've been involved in independent journalism for some time now, with a special accent to even a fetish, if you will, on, exposing a hypocrisy of Canadian foreign policy. I was actually active in the Canada-Haiti Action Network, which is another instance of saying one thing and doing another and having a complete information blackout. But I got to confess, I was largely ignorant of this Honduran coup. And until I read your book, completely oblivious to the extent of Canada's complicity in this endeavor. I just want to back up a little bit just to help set the stage. Could you explain to us what makes Honduras – such a valuable prize for imperialist nations generally, if there is just one or two attributes?
Yeah, you know, Honduras, as I, you know, I sort of spent a lot of time there and got to know the country really well and met a lot of people, did a lot of reading. And Honduras is a place that has been experiencing various forms of colonialism and imperialism for over 500 years. You know, it's one of the first places that Columbus himself actually lands. You know, 300 or so years of Spanish colonialism, followed by all kinds of interference from Britain and then the United States. And of course, the United States, you know, really makes Honduras part of its backyard. The banana companies essentially run Honduras. You know, about 110 years ago, they were basically in charge, and they're fighting wars. You know, banana empires are fighting wars with each other over Honduras.
With United little, Fruit, Standard Fruit.
Yeah, yeah. Cuyamel, the whole, they were all there. In fact, that's the term Banana Republic comes from Honduras. And so there is a long history there of colonialism. And the modern experience of colonialism, I think, begins in the 80s. You know, after there had been a few years of social reform and Honduran working class and peasant movements fighting for, you know, gradual improvements and land reform and so on. In the 1980s, when the U.S. Invades Central America to carry out wars predominantly against Nicaragua, but also against the guerrillas in Guatemala and El Salvador, they use Honduras as their base. And so Honduras is essentially, well, it was nicknamed the USS Honduras because it was occupied by the U.S. military for the better part of a decade and essentially run by the U.S. ambassador. So it's a pretty dark time in Honduran history. And of course, once the wars end, neoliberalism is you know, there is asserted because there's no protest movement left in Honduras. Anyone who was an activist, anyone who was on the left was killed or run out of town. So neoliberalism is installed or imposed on Honduras. There's a series of governments in the late 19 or from the beginning of the 1990s into the early 2000s. And it's the wholesale dismantling of every progressive, you know, policy designed to distribute wealth, to protect the poor. But what's interesting is that in that brutal period, Honduran activists start to get organized again. And there is the beginnings of a social movement. And they crop up all over these activist networks, crop up all over the country dealing with different issues. And you ask the question, well, what is the prize? Well, mining, for instance, is one of the prizes in Honduras. There are mineral deposits, gold and others in Honduras, which foreign capital really wants to get at and profit from. And so since the 1990s, they've been able to do that. And foreign capital, especially Canadian capital, which is the largest mining investor in the country, goes in, they grab territory, typically grab it from indigenous communities without consent, and they build these mines, these really exploitative and environmentally destructive mines, which often leave all kinds of poison in the rivers and in the soil and so on. And as a result, community resistance starts to build. It starts in the late 90s and throughout the decade of the 2000s, there is this building movement of resistance. So much so that it actually forms a national social movement. They had a name, they were organized, and this is environmentalists, this is indigenous groups, this is women's groups, this is trade unions, campesinos, a whole spectrum of Honduran society that is pushing back against neoliberalism. And it all comes to a head in 2009 under President Zelaya, because President Zelaya, who, by the way, was a pretty standard Honduran politician, when he was elected, you know, he wasn't a radical.
He was no Salvador Allende.
He was not at all, not even close. He was a very standard politician, comes from the ruling class himself. In fact, his father had been implicated in the assassination of campesinos in the 70s. So this was no radical. But what happened was, by the time he was elected in 2005, the Honduran social movement was so strong that they were able to really impose pressure on Manuel Zelaya such that he had to listen. He had to adapt to their demands. For instance, immediately after he was elected, there was a massive protest that basically shut down the capital city, demanding that the president uphold a moratorium on mining concessions, grant no further mining concessions to any companies until all of the laws, the mining code, had been rewritten in a way that would be, you know, more protective of indigenous land, more protective of the environment, where they'd have to pay greater taxes and so on. And Zelaya had to uphold that moratorium because the social movement basically shut down the capital city until he did.
So there was no campaign promise with regard to reforming the mining conditions or anything like that?
Not that I recall. And if there had been, it would have been a promise that he
Nothing
would have reneged
that
on.
That was really emphasized.
Exactly.
As a, yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. He would easily, like many liberal politicians before him, he would easily have, you know, maybe made the promise but then not stuck to it. But the social movement made him stick to it. And that was what separated Manuel Zelaya, was that he arrived at this moment that the social movement was so strong that they could actually force some kind of reform. So there was the mining thing, but there was also increases to minimum wage demanded by the social movement, which Zelaya did in an effort to stop protests and strikes and other manifestations. There were other measures that Zelaya took as a result of this pressure from the social movement. And so throughout Zelaya's time in office, there is this schism developing between, and Zelaya is in the middle of it. There's the social movement on the left pushing for reform. There is the oligarchy, the old ruling class, the 10 families, as they're called in Honduras, who basically own everything and who are very closely linked with foreign capital investment, foreign companies. So social movement on the left, the oligarchy on the right, Zelaya in the middle. He comes from the oligarchy, but he is increasingly being pulled to the social movement to sort of protect his own political position.
I want to explore another dynamic that may be in play. It seems to me that the oligarchy or the capitalist class, it's not all kind of homogenous. Some elements were more adversely affected by the structural adjustment programs and the export emphasis than others. And it seems to me that that's another factor in Zelaya's aligning himself with these or capitulating, if that's the term, for these with these social movements. I wonder if you could maybe clarify that, you know, the motivations that are affecting this man, to what extent it is this I was pushed into it by the working class versus, well, maybe I can work with them to advance my own private agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's looking at it and saying, well, you know, the social movement demands mostly affect this group of, you know, this faction of the ruling class that is not mine, right? I'm not affected by this. My own ruling class position is not directly affected by these demands. And in particular, Zelaya's family was a ranching family, not very wound up with transnational capital, very much sort of just a Honduran capitalist in Honduras. And most of the social movement demands were around capital that was linked to foreign investment. So a lot of it was around mining. That was a really big flash point. The palm, African palm plantations in the north. So there was that faction of capital much more connected to a more modern transnational looking faction of the Honduran ruling class. And so, yeah, Zelaya looks at it, you know, and says, hey, you know, I can kind of use this social movement as a wedge against my competitors, right? And it's a wonderful kind of insight into the irrationality of capitalism in a way, right? Where the capitalist class is always sort of torn between, do we collaborate as a class to maintain our domination, or do we compete with each other for the profits that come from that exploitation, right? And Zelaya is kind of trying to play both in a way. And of course, it doesn't work. I mean, inevitably, this was, you know, you could sort of tell. And I think by 2008 and early 2009, it was clear that some kind of confrontation was brewing. Zelaya had been pulled further and further to the side of the social movement, to the point that he really depended on the social movement, because the social movement was the base now for his political projects, for what his political survival, because he had lost most of his allies in the oligarchy. And so, interestingly enough, in the primaries for the elections that were to be held in November of 2009, before the coup took place, Zelaya did not endorse the candidate from his own party. He actually endorsed an independent candidate from the social movement. The social movement had a candidate that was meant to run in these next elections. This was a factor as well in the coup. The idea that the reform that had happened under Zelaya could continue and even be deepened into the next presidential term. man named Carlos H. Reyes was the independent candidate. Comes out of the trade union movement, very widely respected on the left in Honduras, and he was Zelaya's preferred candidate. He was the endorsed candidate for the 2009 elections. So there was clearly a conflict brewing, and I think that's why the oligarchy chose the moment it did in June of 2009 to say enough is enough.
It seems to me that this issue of constitutional changes was a major, at least in terms of the condemnation of Zelaya and the kind of shrugging of the shoulders in the face of the coup. I mean, was there something about the Constitution itself, or was it just a question of using it as, well, this guy just wants to use these changes to stay in power, like Chavez, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So what is your reading into that, the idea of the Constitution as being, I don't know, the straw that broke the camel's back, or rather, a mechanism for the public relations campaign against him?
I think it was both. I think that the proposal to reform the Constitution, you know, which has come out of a lot of governments in Latin America in the last 20 years, a lot of the constitutions were written under dictatorships. And so people said, we want to write our own constitution. And so that happened in Venezuela, but it happened elsewhere. And it was a demand that came from the social movement that Zelaya was open to. And I think about half of the concern was that the oligarchy thought, oh, geez, they might actually change the laws, and they might write laws that, you know, that are going to affect our interests. We don't want that. We can't allow that. But I think they also seized upon what they thought would be a really good, as you say, a public relations device, which is that by presenting Zelaya as changing the Constitution to stay in power for life, there was something about that particular narrative that they correctly believed would fly really well in the mainstream media around the world, and especially in North America, where they had to make sure that they, you know, they needed the support of the U.S. and Canada. And it was brilliant because they were able to, and you know, you're reading the papers. I was reading the papers in Canada throughout this period, and both in the newspapers and in the official statements that Canada made, there was constant reference to this sort of shadowy possibility that Manuel Zelaya was really a dictator. He was really a dictator. He was trying to seize power. He was going to manipulate the Honduran people into letting him run for re-election. And then he was going to run for, and then he was just going to stay there forever. This is farcical. This is absolute fabrication. It wasn't even possible under the process that had been undertaken that Zelaya could run for re-election. The poll that happened in June, the one that was interrupted by the coup, was a non-binding referendum, simply taking the temperature of Hondurans on whether they wanted to reopen the Constitution. If they had said yes, Manuel Zelaya would have put on the November ballot, along with the candidates that you vote for, a question: do you support the striking of a constituent assembly to rewrite the Constitution, yes or no? So already by the time people are voting yes or no to the idea of rewriting the Constitution, Zelaya is out of office. He's done. If they had said yes, the actual process of striking a committee and rewriting the Constitution would have taken years. Zelaya would have long been out of office by then. There was no possibility. It was utterly farcical to suggest that Zelaya was going to stay in power for life, that was his plan. But it played really well in North American media. You know, people just ate it up as like, oh, well, you know, they had to deal with him because he was trying to stay in power forever. And there's a fabulous and horrible irony that I want to connect to this, which is that right now, in 2017, the current president, under the military dictatorship that took power in 2009, has rewritten the Constitution to allow for re-election, and he is currently running for re-election. So the very claim, the very basis upon which the Honduran military overthrew the Zelaya government, and which Canada accepted and repeated around the world, is currently now taking place under the military government of Juan Orlando Hernandez, and not a word is being said.
Pretty glaring double standard.
It's really quite something, isn't it?
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we're interviewing Tyler Shipley, Professor of Culture, Society, and Commerce at the Humber Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning and author of the recent book Ottawan Empire, Canada and the Military Coup in Honduras. This interview was conducted in July while he was in Winnipeg as part of his book tour. In the remaining part of our show, we'll continue the interview along with some recorded excerpts of his talk at McNally Robinson Booksellers where he launched the book. In this clip, Shipley addresses Canada's involvement in the Central American country in the context of the mythology around Canada as a non-aggressive, peaceful, and benevolent player on the world stage.
I think at the heart of this book, it is an argument about the need to re-examine what we think it means to be Canadian. And we've all just been through the Canada 150 thing. So much of what is happening in the Canada 150 thing is about telling us a particular story about what it means to be Canadian. And it's a great story. It's a wonderful story, one that I for a long time believed and liked and made me feel good about myself. It's one that misses a huge part of what is really happening, what Canada is actually doing, what the Canadian state is actually doing. And as such, I think it does a disservice to many Canadians who probably wouldn't like what the Canadian state does in our name. And Honduras is one case study in that.
Honduras is for me, a really interesting case study in Canadian imperialism because unlike some other cases, you know, you mentioned Haiti, Canada directly participated militarily in the kidnapping of President Aristide in Haiti, or Afghanistan, where clearly Canada occupied the country for over a decade, helped write some of the laws. Honduras is different because there was no occupation of the country by Canada. There were no boots on the ground, so to speak. But I would argue that what Canada did in Honduras is actually a perfect crystallization of the new imperialism, a kind of imperialism that doesn't necessitate territorial domination. So what basically played out was that in the moment of the coup, as I mentioned, I was there and Canada was the last country to make a statement. All of the other heads of state on the day of the coup, happened early in the morning, all of the heads of state, you know, issued statements immediately saying, we condemn this, the president must be reinstated, the perpetrators of this coup should be put in jail, put in front of an international court, and so on. Canada waits and waits and waits. Even the U.S. had already issued a statement. And about 12 hours later, along comes Canada and finally issues a statement saying, Canada condemns the coup d'etat, but, you know, we call upon all parties to show restraint and seek a peaceful resolution, which is really duplicitous, isn't it? When the military kidnaps a president in his pajamas, flies him out of the country, forges a resignation letter, it declares martial law, starts killing people in the streets, it's not really two sides that need to show restraint. And to say so, I think, is actually a really manipulative or a real manipulation of the truth. Right?
Careful you don't bruise their knuckles with your face.
Exactly. So that really set the tone for what Canada did over the next 6 months, which was to issue these statements to kind of frame the situation, especially not just in the media, but also with respect to international organizations like the UN or the OAS. Canada consistently framed the situation as being there are two sides. There's a political crisis. They said this. After a couple of months, Canada stopped using the word coup and started using the term political crisis, which is very different, carries a very different tone. And if you don't know what's happening in Honduras and you hear political crisis, that could be anything. That could certainly be two sides fighting over power, which is how Canada framed it. Well, there's Zelaya over here and there's the new president Micheletti over here and they're fighting over power. I know, why don't we have an election and neither of those two guys can run and then things will just get back to normal. I mean, that's not even close to what was really happening in Honduras. But Canada consistently made those statements and that played to the advantage of the military dictatorship that had taken power. And, you know, you might say, well, I guess Canada sort of was an error in judgment, except that Over the following the election, when Pepe Lobo was elected president, he was one of the perpetrators of the coup and supporters of the coup, and he became the new president under very sketchy circumstances. Canada was one of the first to recognize that government. Canada worked very hard to reintegrate that government back into international organizations, and Canada signed a free trade agreement with that government. It was a fascinating sort of revelation, I think, of what was behind Canada's policy in Honduras. Because previous to the coup, or prior to the coup, Canada had been negotiating a free trade agreement with the CA4, which is the four largest economies in Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. And they were all negotiating together. Immediately after the coup, Canada cuts off talks with this multilateral group of states and starts having bilateral talks with just Honduras, just this military dictatorship, which I think is the conclusion is very clear. Canada knows that it can get a really good deal from a military dictatorship, that it's not afraid to use violence to crack down on protesters, trade unionists, campesinos fighting for land, indigenous people trying to protest against a mine. So Canada sought out a close relationship with the Honduran military government because it knew that that could be beneficial for Canadian capital. And of course it has been. And Canada, since the coup, has increased its investment. Canadian companies have increased their investment in the country. And Canada has been the strongest, one of the strongest, if not the strongest supporter of the Honduran government since the coup.
One thing I do remember about Canada's involvement in Honduras was those mining companies. And I know there were a couple of very high profile, well, at least in alternative media circles anyway, of mining practices where Canadian governments were, or Canadian companies were complicit. And, you know, that's just like, it was recently as 2008 before this coup took place. And so you have a pretty good read on how the mining companies have, or mining profits have performed in the wake of this new government.
Yeah, I mean, it's mining companies. It's also garment manufacturing,
like Gildan.
Gildan is the
they're
largest.
Big in Haiti.
they're Haiti and Honduras, and it's not a coincidence, right? Two of the poorest states in the Western Hemisphere. Gildan, for those that don't know, is a garment manufacturing. They make t-shirts, socks, sweatshirts, and so on, based in Montreal, and they are the largest private sector employer in Honduras, in the whole country. They have several large, like mega plants, factories, sweatshops is what we would call them. They really are sweatshops. They are incredibly exploitative employer. Most of the people who work there are women, typically younger women. The level of exploitation, the sort of the workplace violence that takes place is tremendous. There's a women's organization in Honduras that formed basically around these Gildan factories, and they have written open letters. They have sent materials to, you know, openly to the Canadian government and various branches of the Canadian government to say, here's what's happening in the factories. You know, here's how long we work. Here are the injuries that we get. This is the name of the company doctor who injects us with painkillers. This is the quotas that we're expected to meet. Here's what happens to us if we don't meet these quotas. All of this information. And the Canadian government reads all this or doesn't read it, and then uses Gildan as an example of ethical practice. Stephen Harper went to Honduras in 2011 for the signing of the free trade agreement and went to a Gildan factory, toured the facility, and glowed in the media, Honduran media and Canadian, about how Canadian companies like Gildan are a shining example. And they're an example.
CSR.
Yeah, of corporate social responsibility. Look at what this wonderful company is doing. I mean, this is as brazen a lie as you could imagine, but not that that's surprising. But you know, so there's garment manufacturing. We talked about mining. There's also the tourist industry on Honduras's north coast. This is very, you know, beautiful beaches in the north coast, and this is almost all traditional Garifuna territory. The Garifuna are an Afro-indigenous civilization. They've lived in this place for hundreds of years, and they have claim to this land. In fact, I believe their culture is protected by UNESCO, to the extent that that matters. But you know, they are a distinct cultural group, and needless to say, they deserve to be allowed to live their lives as they want to live their lives. But they can't, because Canadian developers have been stealing, buying, seizing, and dividing the territory on which they live in order to build retirement villas, resort hotels, beachfront properties, cruise ports, and shopping malls. They've just ravaged this ecosystem along the North Coast where these people live. And so that's another industry where Canadian capital is heavily invested in the country. And, you know, you can sort of trace these links back to, well, okay, why is Canada supporting a military dictatorship in the country? Because the military dictatorship is good for these and other Canadian companies that operate in a, you know, in the country. So it's yeah. It's a pretty clear line.
Yeah, you evoke the Smedley Butler line that we made, exactly. You know, Honduras, you know, a place for doing business or whatever the line was. But I wasn't able to get through the whole book before this interview, partly because like every few pages I'd go into it, I have to get up and pace and feel like punching something because it's so really disappointing. I just want to go back. You were mentioning about the free trade agreement with Honduras. I mean, there were committee meetings on this, right? And we did have human rights groups and different activist groups and journalists coming forward and giving presentations in front of the committee. Are you privy to how those committee meetings unfolded? Was there any expressions of concern from the commissioners? I mean, these are all party committees, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I wasn't there, so I certainly can't speak authoritatively about it, but I have colleagues that were. You know, my colleague Todd Gordon testified at one of those hearings, and several other people that I know testified in these hearings. And, you know, I think it's actually quite remarkable that in a country where we are convinced that we as Canadians are tolerant and generous and kind and good and well-intentioned, it's remarkable that a group of people can sit down in front of our parliamentary committees and say, here's what's happening in Honduras. People are being killed. People are being tortured. People are being threatened. They're being followed. They're being disappeared. All of this is happening in response to their activist work, complaining about, you know, environmental damage in their communities from the mines, complaining about treatment in the factories, all of these things. It's all very related to capital investment, Canadian investment. And one after another person testifies, tells the Canadian government that this is what's happening. And then the Canadian government ignores it, just ignores it, and goes right ahead and says the opposite in public. Saying that Gildan, for instance, is a wonderful employer.
Of course, if you go to one of the factories, they give you this sanitized tour. And these journalists will come down from the north to well, I want to see what's really happening in these factories. Gildan says, great, yeah, come on in. Let's set the date and time and we'll give you the grand tour. And of course, everything is staged and the workers know it and everyone on staff knows it. And once in a while, there are these sort of cracks in the edifice. There was one... It's a bit of a side note, but there was this one reporter from Montreal who went down and they didn't realize he spoke Spanish. And so they're giving him the tour and they're telling him all this stuff. Of, oh, we give our workers breaks every 15 minutes. We let them stretch. We actually do organized exercises. We don't want them to develop any musculoskeletal problems, of course. And, you know, extolling all the virtues of their corporate practice. And at one point, the reporter says, okay, I'm just going to ask this guy and start speaking in Spanish to the workers to say, like, is this true? Is this really what goes on? And of course, the workers are laughing. Like, this is absurd. No, this is the first day we've ever done yoga. You know, just these absurd sanitized tours of the factories, you know, which allow the Canadian media to give Gildan ethical business awards all the time. They've won an ethical business award from the Globe and Mail, from Maclean's. I think even Harper's government at some point, you know, ranked them one of the best Canadian companies. When Harper went to Honduras, he extolled the virtues of Gildan and said, you know, Honduran companies could learn a thing or two from the practices, the ethical practices of Gildan, this sweatshop garment manufacturing company from Montreal.
Gildan, they win corporate social responsibility awards from the Globe and Mail, from Maclean's. They're lauded by the Canadian government. I could show you documents after document after document detailing the terrible treatment of their workers. I mean, it's not a mystery. It's not a, you don't have to dig very deep to find it. As a matter of fact, if you go to Gildan's Wikipedia, just the Wikipedia, you will find a laundry list of violations of labor codes, violations of human rights. They've been taken to court so many times. There have been so many scandals. And yet the Canadian government just lies right through their teeth about it. So, no, I wasn't privy to the actual, you know, the considerations that those parliamentary committees had. But my guess, I mean, clearly the result is that if anyone objected, they were overruled. And the Canadian government went full steam ahead with that free trade agreement and continued. And I should say continues to this day, because there is sometimes a tendency to think, oh, it was Harper.
Harper.
Yeah. It was Harper.
We got sunny ways, yeah. Trudeau and Tap Power.
Oh, it's all fixed up now, isn't it? And of course it isn't. Things are as bad as they've ever been in Honduras, and things are also as profitable as they've ever been for Canadian capital. Nothing has changed as a result of the rise of the Sun King, Trudeau. So, you know, I think that's an important point to keep in mind too.
Tyler, I really want to help Mimi to really help our listeners get a grasp of what we're talking about. If you could point out a few examples of these intense crackdowns on these social movements and the intimidation that's happening, you know, where it's not just the activists but their family members that are getting attacked and even killed. Is there a couple of examples that really stand out for you that'll haunt the dreams of our listeners?
I mean, it's so awful, and I sort of forget. I actually don't talk about it as much because often I'm talking about this stuff with people who are familiar with Central America, and so they're familiar with the patterns of violence, and so I don't often talk about it because it's really quite graphic and horrific. You know, but to give just a bit of a slice of it, and I document a lot of these cases in the book. You know, it's not just that people die, you know, and you know, there's a big group protesting and shots are fired and a few people get killed. It's not just like that. People are targeted for their specific work within the social movement. They're often very specifically personally targeted. And it's not always leaders in particular. It can just be, you know, a big personality in a teacher's union. Teachers have been one of the groups that have been targeted because teachers are among the more progressive groups within Honduran society. They're, you know, often outspoken leaders within the movement. So teachers will be targeted. There was a teacher who was shot on his front step of his house by men on motorcycles, a death squad hit. And that happened after several days of the motorcycles driving around the neighborhood, basically as a threat. There was a case where a journalist who was – the media has been almost totally shut down. The critical elements within the media have been almost totally shut down. So that the media in Honduras is almost all owned by the oligarchy, says good things about the oligarchy, says that the coup was good and necessary and so on. But there are still pockets of independent media. And, you know, Radio Globo is one of these pockets. And so a journalist who works with Radio Globo, which is critical of the coup – came home one day to find his 17-year-old daughter hanged from a tree in front of the house. She had nothing to do with the movement, not in particular. She's 17 years old. She was targeted in order to get at her father and to intimidate her father into not speaking critically about the government on the radio. I mean, that's the level of violence that we're talking about. And this carries through, you know, those are both cases from early on, but this violence has carried through right into the present. And of course, the most obvious example in the last few years is the assassination of Berta Cáceres. Berta was one of the biggest names in Honduras, really, in the country. She was well known. She had been an activist for many years. She was an indigenous woman. I met her many times. I had immense respect for her. Just a phenomenal intellect, an indomitable will. And in particular, she had been fighting with her community against the construction of a hydroelectric dam on their land that would dam the river that they depend upon. And it was being built without their consent. So she was opposed to this project. And she had been threatened hundreds of times. And I remember sitting with her once in a cafe, and she was just sort of listing these different threats that she'd gotten, you know, and a range of seriousness. You know, sometimes it's you get a text, in the night that says, we're watching you. You know, sometimes little things would be left, little gifts left on the front step so that you know that they know where you live, that they've been watching you. Often Berta would get messages saying, how are your daughters doing in their trip? I hear they went to New York, which is designed to tell Berta, we know where your daughters are. We can get them because we know what they're doing. Right? We've got you under surveillance. It's all of these different kinds of threats. And then, of course, just outright threats all the time. And what makes it so terrifying, of course, in Honduras is that they are not idle threats. And in Berta's case, they got to her. They assassinated her in 2015. And you know, with Berta, there was a sense that she was such a prominent figure that they couldn't really kill her. You know, they kill lesser known activists, people whose names aren't going to make much of a blip on the radar and aren't going to get into the international press. But Berta Cáceres had won the Goldman Environmental Award within the last year. She had gone to San Francisco to give an acceptance speech. You know, it's all over the internet. She's a widely known, internationally recognized activist. And they still killed her. So that, I think, was a message to people in Honduras that even the most prominent activist in the country can be assassinated, and by the way, they got away with it. I mean, nothing has changed. It's not like the international community suddenly stopped doing business with Honduras. It's not like the country has a blockade or an embargo placed upon it. It happened, the moment passed, and it's you know, it's allowed to continue. That says to any activist in the country, we can get you. You can be gotten to. So I mean, it's bleak, and you know, talking about this stuff, it's hard to even remember to find hope. I mean, there is hope. There is a movement that, in spite of all of this, continues to resist the military dictatorship there. But what I think it's important to keep in mind in the Canadian context is that that's the government Canada's supporting, a government that will, you know, support and possibly even arrange the assassination of Berta Cáceres, one of the best known activists whose crime is to protect her own land, her community, from an environmentally destructive dam that would disrupt the community's, you know, functional lives. And Canada is on the side of the dictatorship that carries that out. And that should be a wake-up call to Canadians. That should be something that says to all of us, we really need to rethink, you know, all of these 150 celebrations and all of the certainty that Canada is doing good in the world. There is a very obvious, and this is just one very obvious case where that is not happening. And that should force us to be asking tough questions.
Where are all these award-winning Canadian journalists on this? You know, why is this not considered news fit to print? What do you make of that?
You know, I think that it's a reflection of the extent to which the Canadian mainstream media is a mouthpiece for corporate Canada. And that doesn't mean that individual reporters are told what to say. You know, I mean, it's not like a company representative phones up an individual reporter and tells them what to say. That sort of is conspiratorial and silly. But the way a corporate media works is that there is a sort of a editorial structure, you know, where a particular line comes down from the top, and reporters know that they have a certain amount of wiggle room to work with. It's not that the Canadian press never writes critical stuff about Honduras. They do once in a while.
You have to look for it.
But you got to find it. You got to really search it out. You got to force it in there. You know, I'm constantly contacting the media saying, hey, why don't you write a story about this? Do you want to interview me about this? Maybe we should talk about this. Can I write a piece about this? I'm constantly trying to push this stuff into the media. And when it does get there, it's hard to get a really critical line to come through in the story. I was successful in working with a reporter from City TV recently to get about a minute or two of pretty solid critique of Canada's position in Honduras. You know, that's a win, but these are small wins. You know, this should be something that's being talked about all the time. This should be
like Syria.
Yes, exactly. This should be front page news consistently. There should be, like, Justin Trudeau should be held to account to this. He should be answering questions about it. Canadian MPs should be forced to deal with it. And yet that pressure isn't there. And I think that's a reflection of how cowardly and corporatized most of the Canadian mainstream media has become. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're almost at the end of our time, but I just want to remind listeners, the book is Ottawa and Empire, Canada and the Military Coup in Honduras. The author is Tyler Shipley, with whom we're speaking right now. Tyler, is beyond your book, are there any other resources that you would like to point listeners to if they want to inform themselves or if they want to get active and trying to make a difference?
Absolutely. There's a wonderful organization called the Honduras Solidarity Network. And I think there's lots of good information there. And there are also delegations. And that's actually how I started. When I first went to Honduras, I went on a delegation by, at that time, it was an organization called Rights Action that I went with, a Canadian and US NGO that does, political advocacy stuff in Central America. And, these delegations are a great way for people to not just learn about what's happening in a place, but also connect with it emotionally. There's so much bad news to read in the world, right? But going to a place, meeting people, talking to people, meeting family members, of people who've been killed and so on, it really makes it more concrete. It makes it more real, and it gives you such a fuller experience of what's happening. And so those two organizations, the Honduras Solidarity Network and Rights Action, they publish information, but they also run these delegations. And I strongly encourage people to consider getting involved and going on these delegations and actually kind of seeing, Honduras is a scary place. I think a lot of people are just quite honestly afraid to go there. But the truth is, going with a delegation is precisely the way to do it, because you're going with people who know the country, who can sort of guide you through getting to know the basics of what's happening there. So I really do recommend those. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Tyler Shipley, it's been a pleasure speaking with you and hearing your thoughts on this very important foreign affairs file. And we wish you all the best with the book and your upcoming tours.
Thanks very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to talk about all this with you.
Okay, thanks.
It's a small, concentrated group of extremely wealthy Canadians who are essentially crafting these policies or helping to craft these policies. And it does a disservice to a lot of people in Canada and in other parts of the world. A lot of things are done in Canada's name that I don't think many of us in this room would support, would endorse. Certainly what I've documented in Honduras is one example, but there are many others. And Afghanistan is the obvious case to look at, I think, in recent time. A lot of things that Canada has done in Afghanistan that even many Canadian soldiers aren't fully comfortable with and haven't been fully comfortable with is part of the reason so many of them come back with various forms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Because a lot of what is taking place in Canada's name would not be supported by average Canadians. And I hope that this book goes at least some way to helping some of us actually develop an analysis of Canada that is critical, that isn't just, we're polite, we say sorry a lot. We could actually do with saying a lot more sorry in the world right now. There's a lot of things that Canada really ought to be sorry for. And so I hope that this book will at least spark some discussion around that.
We've been listening to Tyler Shipley, Professor of Culture, Society, and Commerce at the Humber Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning, and author of the recent book, Ottawa and Empire, Canada and the Military Coup in Honduras. Professor Shipley will be speaking again in Toronto on Wednesday, October 11th, at Toronto Reference Library's Hinton Auditorium at 789 Yonge Street. For more information or to purchase a copy, visit the website for the publisher Between the Lines at btlbooks.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.